Hi, this is Paul. I mentioned a few days ago that I listened to the Jordan Peterson, Andrew Schultz, I don't know how to pronounce his last name, finally found his YouTube channel, found Huberman on there. That was kind of an interesting talk. Get a sense for this guy. Like I said, I didn't really feel a lot of chemistry with him on the Jordan Peterson thing, but there were a ton of really good, interesting nuggets in this conversation that I thought were very worthwhile sort of pulling out. I haven't really taken the time to sort of pull them out, but the other day I got into it on Twitter. I gotta watch that Twitter thing. I got into it on Twitter because what's going on Twitter right now, for those of you who aren't on Twitter, and by me talking about what's going on Twitter, I am very much not recommending that you go on Twitter. Twitter is a thing, and it's, we all have our temptations on it. But part of what's going on Twitter is that Elon Musk, as you've probably heard in the much broader news, has taken over Twitter. And, well, maybe I should just pull up the tweet that I made. I tweeted, "It is really interesting watching the difference between Twitter being a plaything of a known living human being or a principality." That, of course, got a little bit of attention from people who very much want to see the world as sort of a new atheist sees it. But then it drove me to finally clip out this clip. Because what's going on Twitter, besides the resurrection of all sorts of accounts that had been suspended or banned or this or that, which is sort of like watching how many different TV shows and movies that have come out in the last 10 years that try to, in one way or another, imagine, let's say, a Lazarus resurrection and not a Jesus resurrection. Because what C.S. Lewis has to say about the Jesus resurrection is quite a bit different. But Twitter had been managed by a group of people. It had been managed by a principality. It had been managed by a Geist. So, of course, our friendly little corner nemesis, Digital Gnosis, jumps onto my tweet and says, "Principality is not a real thing, or not a real kind." Did he meant to say thing is kind? Maybe that's English language instead of American. "Principality is not a real kind. It's reified mumbo jumbo that you're using to play word association with some verse in the Bible in order to make the claim that Twitter was controlled by demons or other shite." I do want to make a video about demons because it's not what you think I mean. There's a lot to say about that. I've got a lot of videos I want to make, and this is kind of a week that's a short week for me. I have to get all my work in. Thursday is American Thanksgiving. Friday, I'm going to take off, like many Americans are. Saturday is my usual day off. And then Sunday is, of course, all of the church stuff. So we'll see how much content I get to make this week. But that, I knew, was, well, a principality. What do you mean by that? A spirit. What do you mean by that? And it reminded me of what was really a terrific segment of this video with Jordan Peterson. Because what they describe is just such an amazing description of seeing this principality, this spirit from underneath it, and shows the difficulty that we have comprehending it. And so then I went on to make the point that Twitter has either been controlled by a massive conspiracy or a principality. But we say, well, there's no such thing. Well, is there such a thing as a racism that controls the American culture since, you know, some 1619 or whatever date you want to? Is there such a thing as a capitalism which manages our economy? Is there such a thing as, I mean, these are the sort of things that John Vervaeke calls hyper things. And Jonathan Peugeot and I usually use more biblical language like principality, spirit. I referenced on Twitter the difference between a Geist and a ghost, and yeah, I understand that in many ways Geist is just the German translation of spirit, but when you say it in English, it sort of has a different nuance. But let's hear this, let's hear this this segment from Schultz.
Story is I was originally going to do it with a streamer, right? And then they were unhappy with some jokes.
It was going to do a show with a streamer.
I think the climate changed a little bit and they were quite concerned how the jokes could reflect on the brand, which is...
You know, even the climate changed. Do you mean the temperature? Do you mean the weather patterns? No, we all know he doesn't mean that. Well, what does he mean the climate changed? What exactly is it that changed? Now, again, in public discourse, you can say the climate changed and nobody bats an eye. But once you say there's such a thing as the climate in that sense, besides the other sense too, there's such a thing as the climate. What exactly is that? And you start poking around at that and a whole bunch of new atheist types then suddenly get a little defensive. It's like, no, you're going to jump in with your Bible stuff. Well, please tell me what this is then if you don't like the old language that people have been using for thousands of years to talk about the climate.
And then they were unhappy with some jokes. I think the climate changed a little bit and they were quite concerned how the jokes could reflect on the brand, which is reasonable. I think that like a private corporation has the right to make those decisions for themselves and then, you know, see how things go for them after that. Now, sometimes those decisions could be the wrong ones. You know, you could make...
A part of what's really interesting about Twitter is that for a long time with Google's decisions and Twitter's decisions and Facebook's decisions, everybody from one side of the political aisle runs in and says, a private corporation can make the decisions they want. And then Elon Musk buys Twitter, and suddenly people are worried that, you know, a national treasure of the United States is being violated by Elon Musk. It's like, he bought it. He owns it. And so then, oh, I've got to get off of it because now it's suddenly contaminated by Elon Musk.
Maybe become too woke in your content and then end up losing money, but...
No, that could never happen. Too woke? How could that possibly be? Too woke for comedy?
Yeah.
I can't even imagine that's a thing.
No, but... Okay, side note. I mean, I want to get back to the special, but there is something interesting that I've learned from, like, being in Hollywood a little bit more now is that, like... I used to have the perception.
Now, notice how he ties it to a geography. Is it tied to the land? You know, all of the stuff that's rumbling in my head from 1 Corinthians 8 through 10. I didn't say Ephesians 6. Those of you who know your Bible know what I'm talking about. Those of you who don't will remain in mystery until you actually get well-versed in the Bible and joined the very long conversation of Western civilization. Even Richard Dawkins acknowledges that if you want to be an educated person in the West, you have to one degree or another, know the Bible. But notice how it's tied to a geography. But again, Hollywood isn't just a geography. I've been to Hollywood, and it's kind of grungy. It's not much fun. You can find those, you know, those handprints and stuff in front of the Chinese theater, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But Hollywood is in some ways what is it? A hyper thing? Is it a spirit? Is it a principality? Is it a geist? It's something. It's certainly something that's a collective. We participate in it. It's like school spirit. But it's also something that has an existence that predates all of us, unless you were born, unless you're very old at this point, since we're now in the 2020s. So this is something that we all talk about all the time, effortlessly, without controversy. And we say nothing about it or nothing against it, but then when you try to actually take a look at it and talk about it, not in the way that everyone does, well, the climate has changed. Well, how are we going to change the climate? Well, the spirit has changed. How are we going to change the spirit? That word will sometimes get a pass. But then people are like, it's not a thing. It's like, are you serious? Are you serious? All of the social drama we have had in how long about almost everything that people in the intelligentsia are worried about in the country, whether it's going in the right direction or going in the wrong direction. They don't want to talk about what it is or what goes into it. But here we are talking about it non-controversially.
You know, I think we all create these perceptions where it's like, there's this like group of organized individuals that are like coming together and making decisions on like what is palatable and what isn't palatable, and then inserting those into culture in their like different fields, like Hollywood, one of them. Okay, all the movies this year are going to be about non-binary or whatever it is. And after being in it a little bit more, I think that it's way less organized and more about self-preservation. So it's like, how do I not lose my job?
Well, I worked with middle managers for a long time when I was selling personnel evaluation technology to corporations. And I did that for about 10 years, rather unsuccessfully. We found one company right. that used them extensively. But I learned very rapidly there that the fundamental motivation of virtually every middle manager in a corporation is, how can I not get blamed if something goes wrong?
Yes.
That's it, man. Yeah. There's no yeah. ambition. There's no desire yeah. to grow the company. There's nothing yes. but I don't want to stick out. If there's a mistake, I don't want it to be on me. I hope I yes. don't get blamed for anything. I'm not going to do anything dangerous ever. And
yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the idea that people are organized enough to have a conspiracy is that that's just so rarely the case.
But I was part of that belief a little bit because you
And again, when I said on Twitter, it's a conspiracy or it's something else. Okay, what is that other thing? Oh, it's the ascendant morality. Well, those are the words that I use of it. It's just the right thing. Oh, well, when did this just the right thing emerge? What was it before the just the right thing? And again, what was the it? Don't talk about the it. It prefers to stay in the background. It prefers to allow us to sort of imagine that we're in control. What is the it?
See, and it looks so obvious. You're like, why is every single movie the same? Every single TV show the same? Are they having the same values? But then after, like I had a moment on a show a while ago where a guy got fired, a white older man got fired because he read the N-word. Like he read the script and it had the N-word in it. And like the whole cast was kind of like, well, the people I spoke to on the cast, even the black people in the cast were like, yeah, I don't think it's that offensive. But the companies involved were thinking what the middleman was thinking, what you just said, which was, okay, I don't want to be responsible for this. How do I get this blame off of me? Okay, maybe if we just remove this person, it'll be a sign that we care about the people that are here and we don't want them to be offended, et cetera. Now, I don't believe that the guy did it out of malice. And the black people that I spoke to on the cast were like, yeah, I don't think he was being malicious at all. But it was one of those things where everybody was fighting for the ability to continue working and they didn't want to take that responsibility. And because of that, they made a very woke decision.
Yeah.
Now, it's interesting because if you listen to this conversation and you know anything about the Book of Revelation, you might be tempted to say something like, boy, this sounds like something from the Book of Revelation that unless you sort of have the number of the beast, you're not allowed to do commerce. Yeah, that sure is what it sounds like. But don't talk about it. Don't question that. Don't do anything about that. And of course, this is all sort of flipped because let's say 75, 80 years ago, there's a different power that sort of was it. And then the 1960s comes around and we're going to be the counterculture and we're going to turn over the man. And okay, and so that little thing has been running. And now people want to call it a dynamic. They want to call it a culture. But when you start asking much more detailed questions about it, well, then they get nervous. No, don't personify it. Okay, but isn't that exactly what we do? Again, I've made this point many times, that I watch people deconstruct from Christianity. I can't believe that God would let any of these things happen. Oh, okay, fair enough, because, you know, read the book of Habakkuk, which is what I'm preaching on this week, and you'll discover you're not alone. And in fact, people with these thoughts, in fact, contributed pretty significantly to the Bible. Just read the Psalms, read the book of Habakkuk, read, you know, there's a lot of people who looked around the world and said, well, this world doesn't seem to be run as the way that I think it should, even if I've been formed by the story of the God of Moses. It's like, yeah, fair enough. That's very true. But what's going on in terms of how exactly the world runs then? What runs the world? What shapes people? And now, I'm not in any way laying aside psychology or sociology or status. All of those things are part of it. All of those things, we see it through these things. But to talk about it, well, this, then we, does it have consciousness? Well, probably not the kind of consciousness we have, because we talked about this at Thunder Bay, because my dog, I don't have a dog right now, dogs have consciousness, but not like mine. Flies seem to have some consciousness. If I move my hand, the fly moves. Lots of things seem to have consciousness, but not like my consciousness. I'm not saying it has consciousness like we have, but it certainly seems to have something approximating it. And,
yeah. So now it may, you know what I'm saying? It made me look at the industry a little differently. Like everybody, it's like maybe the more desired the job is, the more willing the middle managers will be to be extremely liberal in their values so they don't lose that opportunity. I don't think that exists on a construction site, because the guys there are like, look, I can get a job doing drywall somewhere else. So I'm going to say whatever the fuck jokes I want to say on this construction site.
So I think too, though, there's a complicating factor there, which is it's something like this. So, you know, each of us carries a representation of systems of ideas in our imagination, in our mind. And those ideas are active within us. That's one way of thinking about it. And nobody is a 100% repository of all woke ideas. But so there's fragments of...
Now. What he says there is really critical. In other words, there's no king of wokedom who is enforcing this. And then you could say, oh, if we kill the king of wokedom, then all the woke stuff goes away. No, that's not how it works. And if you talk to people, even people that you might consider to be very woke indeed, and start poking around and asking them questions about this or that or this or that, it's a good faith conversation, you'll find that these people have all sorts of their own critiques about wokeness and this and that, and areas that they're heretical in terms of the woke canon. And you know, you find that all the time, and you find that with religions, you find that, but then you have to ask yourself, what is the thing that we are dealing with? And of course, for Christians, yes, Nathan, Ephesians 6, we battle not with flesh and blood. There's something else going on here. Well, how do we talk about it? Well, let's say if we put up enough flags of many colors, maybe that then will reduce don't ask what's holding the homophobia, but maybe the flags of many colors, and maybe if we give them a month, and maybe all of those things, and then somehow we can reduce we're not going to talk about what it is that's holding all the homophobia over, but... Is there like a king of homophobia that's sort of keeping the whole thing in a certain way? No. So what's going on? How can we have language to talk about this? And as Peugeot noted on Twitter in response to my tweets about this, it's sort of conspiracy theory, which doesn't really hold water, or something else goes on. And again, we've been talking about this in our little corner for quite a while, and I'll play another video from a very interesting conversation between Peugeot and Bernardo Kastrup on this. And, you know, people then sort of dismiss me or dismiss us because they, oh, you're just using language of the Bible. Oh, okay. If you're going to really avoid using language of the Bible, you're going to find yourself with a very limited book of phrases that you're going to be using, because so much of what we use comes from there. And, well, we just know that there's nothing above us. Oh, okay. Now, the other interesting question that I really have to talk to Jonathan about, I should probably send him an email, is because after one of the talks in the Thunder Bay conference, we got going about the Son of Man and how the Son of Man figures into this. And I've been thinking about that. And Nate Heil has read this book on Maximus the Confessor, which costs like $60. And it's like, I don't mind spending $60 for a book, but when I spend $60 for a book, I really want to make sure I read it and it doesn't wind up on the shelf with a bunch of other books that I've read 10 or 20 pages of and thought, eh. So, yeah, call me a cheap Dutchman, but that's the way that is.
The woke net of ideas in any given individual, but if you get 20 people who have fragments of those ideas in their head all together in a room, then you have the whole goddamn woke catastrophe operating,
right.
And then it'll look right. like a conspiracy.
And again, oh, maybe I'll jump in and play a little something from Kurt Germungal, who had a really interesting video. So bringing back Michael Levin, and I've heard Joshua Bach on Lex Fridman. And yeah, I mean, basically we're talking about, okay, so you have 20 little wokesters in the room and together they sort of make a woke hive mind. And again, if I use that, well, we're talking metaphorical, we're talking, we're not talking metaphysical, we're talking metaphorical. Okay, fine. I don't have any problem with understanding these things as metaphor, but at some point we're going to have to ask ourselves how real metaphor is, which is part of my frustration with Cosmic Skeptic, because you know a good honest reading of C.S. Lewis's Miracles might help him out in some of this, because okay, stop using language from the Bible, stop using metaphor, and see how much science you can actually do.
Is that every cell has the ability to send multiple message types and receive multiple message types and do this conditionally and learn under which conditions to do that and to modulate this. Also, every cell is an individual reinforcement learning agent. Single-celled animal that tries to survive by cooperating with its environment gets most of its rewards from its environment. And as a result, this means that every cell can in principle function like a neuron. It can fulfill the same learning and information processing tasks as a neuron. The only difference that exists with respect to neurons, or the main difference, is that they cannot do this over very long distances, because they are mostly connected only to cells that are directly adjacent. Of course, neurons also only communicate to adjacent cells, but the adjacency of neurons is such that they have axons, parts of the cell, that reach very far through the organism.
And now what's really interesting is that, of course, Michael Levin talks about this, how cells communicate in terms of electrochemicals, and all of these cells, of course, I mean, it's happening right now. Peugeot makes this point again and again and again. I myself am a collection of cells. But this collection of cells is in communication with lots of you out there, collections of cells. And there's language and culture, and together we form things. We form cultures, we form communities, we form all sorts of things together. And now that people who are sort of, it's almost like they're wearing glasses that, if anything isn't material, it shutters. But that's how they think. But of course, that doesn't work, because of course the words, well, you know, I'm moving air and it's impacting this mic, but then it gets translated by the. I mean, it just boggles my mind how. Oh, we're just going to call all of this woo. No, this is basically how reality works.
And then you can take 20 different people, each of whom have fragments of the woke nonsense in their head, and put them in a different room. They'll come up with the same decisions. There are these webs of ideas.
Isn't that interesting? They'll come up with the same decisions. This is how history works. This is what historians do, is try to look at these ideas and think about the evolution of ideas and think about all of the factors that go into the evolution ideas and see how things are shaped, and then maybe they could be shaped differently with counterfactuals, et cetera, et cetera.
Ideas that, and in some sense, each of us acts as a neuron in a neuronal web when we're together in a group. And so then Things look conspiratorial, but it's a consequence of the working out of the internal logic of systems of ideas. And so, And then it might be that each individual actor is fundamentally only concerned with not being held accountable for ever making any kind of mistake, which is a hell of a way to live your life. Certainly no way to live your life if you're a comedian or a man, for that matter. Maybe not even a woman, you know, not even.
Yeah, yeah.
That should make me popular.
It was an interesting thing for me to see how it kind of manifested. And I think that there is like an opposite version of that, because now I've seen like the conservative woke pop up. Are you familiar with this?
What are you referring to?
I don't even know if I call it the conservative woke. It's a really interesting thing. I would almost call it like the counterculture brigade, which is like people who I think have been.
And this is where, in some ways, Aaron Wren's negative world and that whole conversation, which I really want to make some videos on. I've just had two phone calls since I've been here. And then it's like, crap, I've got real life things I got to take care of. And here I am making a video. This is part of the torment in me in terms of my day job. It's like, oh, nobody's here right now. I can make a video. And then the phone calls start coming while I'm doing this. But This is where there are streams and winds and cultures and all of this stuff, that all these metaphors that we use to talk about these things.
I think they were called conspiracy theorists, and now they're kind of like searching for a home. I think a lot of
these are spirits in the wilderness looking for a home. That's the best way to talk about them.
Port for Kanye even right now is he's just tapping into very niche beliefs. And a bunch of them at the same time that people have no representation for.
So Peugeot notes today that I saw news of it. We'll see where it goes. Kanye is going to run for president in 2024, and he has hired Milo. He's hired Milo to work on his campaign. I just can't wait for the Republican primaries to watch Trump and Kanye debate.
And now he's the most famous person tapping into those groups, right? So he's like Jordan.
He's participating in a principality, and in a sense, he is a principality by the dynamic that Andrew is about to mention.
He's like George Floyd really died of fentanyl, and now all the people that are anti-Black Matter, Black Lives Matter, they just hate the idea that there's anything else that killed him but his own choice to do fentanyl. Are like, okay, Kanye's got it. And he also did a thing, the Jews run the banks, the Jews run all these things.
And what's amazing is that channels of a certain gnosis live in terror of this dynamic. You know, we've got to announce that everything Jordan Peterson says and does is humbug. And we've got to warn people about this little corner of the internet and all the silliness that they're doing. The mumbo jumbo, all the silliness that they're doing and all of this stuff. We've got to warn people about all of this stuff because, well, it's like, on one hand, you deny the dynamic and then you live in terror of it. I don't know what to say.
Thing. So he's tapped into all these niche groups, and now he's become like their representative. But what I've noticed about these groups is that like they're so scorned by maybe being lied to by the mainstream media or whatever it is, that their personality or identity has almost become the rejection thereof.
Yeah, well, that's always a threat that exists on the conservative side. You know, the left-wingers always accuse the conservatives of being reactionary. And they're reactionary because they keep saying things like, you guys on the left, you're going too far. You got to slow down. You got to stop doing this. You're going too far. And that is reactionary in some sense, because they're always reacting to the excesses of the left. The conservative types tend not to want to change things. And, you know, that can be their downfall, too, because sometimes things have to change, although intelligent conservatives sure know that. But it's hard for the conservatives to come up with a vision and to unite themselves because, well, first of all, they tend to stand for tradition, and it's not that easy to articulate traditional norms. And second, they do get reactionary. And, you know, that can turn into kind of a demented populism, too, because the reactionary conservatives can go out and find the disaffected people on the right, and there's plenty of them now, and then capitalize on their resentment. I mean, Trump was pretty good at that in many ways, and continues to be so, you know. And that's, I haven't been targeted particularly by the right, although I have to some degree years ago. You know, and when I first rose to whatever degree of notoriety I have now, a lot of the disaffected types on the right were also hoping that I'd be their guy. And same thing happened to Dan Crenshaw, the congressman, because he kind of looks, he's got that evil right-wing supervillain appearance.
It's the eye patch.
If you know, in some sense. And they were kind of hoping he'd be their man, and he wasn't. And he actually gets targeted more by the conspiratorial right than he gets harassed by the left, which is quite the accomplishment on Crenshaw's part.
Okay.
Thanks, Brianna. And would you like to phrase what you just described as a question then, Jonathan, take it from there?
Sure. I mean, so maybe I can just, so I've been thinking a lot about the problem of, you know, we talked about the idea of, for example, that China, or like the angel of China or something like that, the idea that there is some kind of agency, there are agencies which act above us, above the human level, and seem to constrain us in our own agency, let's say, as we act.
And what Jonathan just described, agencies above us that constrain us in how we act, agencies above us that enable us to act. Now, what's really good about this conversation is there's a lot of pushback from Bernardo Castrop, and fair enough, and good pushback. And so, you know, they're having a good conversation about this.
And this is something with John Vervaeke we've been discussing a lot. He tends to be willing to use the word agency, though he really wants to avoid the word consciousness in that question. And so that is really what I'm really curious to explore a little more. Based on our discussion, maybe I can start with this. I talked about this idea of, let's say, the angel of China, let's use that word, or the principality of China. And you were bothered by the notion of how is it that it exists, let's say, how is it that it exists outside of the time that China exists in the world? So, right, does it have prior existence? Does it continue to exist after its existence? And reflecting
what is
on
China?
That,
how do you delineate China? That's the other question. Where do you find the spatial boundaries?
Well, I think that I was thinking about that later, and I was starting to wonder if that's not the same problem from in the case of humans as well, right? And the idea that we have permeable boundaries, humans do as well, both mentally, but then also physically. Our physical boundaries, because they're at the level of our perception, we see them as more solid, but they're permeous. And the same would be for a higher being, let's say a city or a state. It has, you can still locate it, even physically in the world. You can locate it conceptually, but it does have permeability on its edges, and it seems to, so you can't fix it that way. It's so, like, here I'm really going to be more like Neoplatonic in the sense that,
and you know, if we talk about Hollywood in this sense, Hollywood of course has some of that,
you can only fix it in its higher aspect. You can fix it in its identity. So it's actually the name used more in a more ancient way that fixes it, and then its manifestation or the quantity of it will always have permeability and change. So it's the ship of Theseus problem, right? It's like, is the ship of Theseus still the ship of Theseus, even though its parts have changed, in my answer would be yes, it is, because it's actually held together by name, by memory, by attention, by all these mechanisms.
Before I comment on that, can I ask you a question inspired by something you said? If I don't ask the question now, it will be lost.
Yeah, sure, go ahead.
You said Joan Vervaeke.
Now I should mention that Kastrup is an interesting conversation and partner in this, because what he is one of the most thoroughgoing idealists that there are out there that you can, let's say, talk to him and have a conversation with him about it. And he's really working that idealism space. And so in many ways, he's the complete opposite of, let's say, new atheist types that are always looking at it down below. They're not even sure that the ship of Theseus, if they were, as C.S. Lewis pointed out how many times, if they were consistent with their creed, there could never be a ship of Theseus. Because as Peugeot notes, that you're really dependent on this, here's the ship of Theseus. You're just dependent upon that perspective on something. And of course, for an idealist, they, in a sense, come from on top, whereas the new atheists come from below.
He was comfortable using the word agency for higher levels of mentation, but not the word consciousness. Do you know what difference he makes in his mind between the two, and why this distinction?
Well, he seems to think, first of all, that conscience is a very specific aspect which has to do with certain amount of speed. And so speed of connection is what would give rise, let's say, to consciousness. I mean, I don't really agree with that myself, but that is his main argument. He might say I'm not getting him right, so let's be careful here. But this is the understanding that I have of his argument, is that in the human brain there's a certain amount of speed of connection and interconnectivity which can give rise to a state of consciousness, but that you can't perceive that, let's say, at the city level. The connections are slow, you know, like writing emails and writing letters and you know, people talking amongst each other in order to organize the activities of the city. You would have
in other words, in Peugeot's system, the city has a consciousness, but the consciousness is very slow and the consciousness is very distributed. A couple of months ago, we had done some tree trimming. The city a while ago decided it no longer wanted to offer garbage service to businesses. And we're sort of a business because we're a church. We're not a household. So we couldn't put our things into the street. We didn't have a green bin for the green waste. And so there's a question about green waste. And so one of our members started putting some things out on the street. Someone from the city came along and said, you can't put your things out on the street until this date, and then you can put them out. Okay. And then I got a little note from the city about food waste, because the city is now changing its policy on food waste. They want food waste in the green waste bin as something that's sort of compostable. And then I got a note from the city at church talking about the fact that by virtue of our category, they didn't consider us needing a food waste. I mean, it just gets crazy, but it's very slow. So then, you know, then I either write back to the city or find someone to call in the city or do the 311 thing here in Sacramento. And it's very slow consciousness, but the elements of consciousness that are a degree of intelligence, a degree of agency, they're present in the city. But again, they're seen from a particular perspective where you're not dissimilar to the Michael Levin, Joshua Bach perspective, where they're looking and saying, well, my whole body is working because all of my cells are talking with each other. And then in a sense, if you imagine it metaphorically, there's sort of a level above the cells that work together. And if of course, in some ways, that's the I consider me, which is something similar to a story. It's immaterial like that. That's me, the story, an immaterial story that is sort of above this vast network of cells that are firing together. It's not material, because the me that goes on is now out on the internet, and it's in the memory of my children, and it's in the consciousness of my wife and of my parents, and my grandparents in some ways live on through me in terms of the organization of the genetics, the amino proteins, I mean, all of this stuff. And this is what we're talking about. It's such a foundational aspect of reality. And then this whole community just kind of turns away from it and says, that's not real. Oh, okay. Suit yourself.
We'd have a slower connection. And so I don't, to be honest, I don't mind that. I think that there are just different types of consciousnesses. I don't mind the idea that it would be a slower consciousness or just a consciousness that has a different.
And this is sort of where some of the sticking points that we arrived at Thunder Bay, when John Vervaeke's lecture about consciousness was basically talking about how, you know, describing consciousness in a scientific sense, where I think Jonathan and Peugeot and I are looking at it and saying, how can we recognize consciousness? Does the sun have consciousness? Is that the best way? Are these the best language tools to talk about these things? Just like Andrew Schultz talks about, you know, the climate changed. That's what we as a culture have sort of agreed upon how to talk about it, but how then to regard the agency of that climate, which is impacting all of the Netflix workers, so that when Andrew Schultz makes a certain number of jokes, everybody says, oh, I don't know if we should do that. And as Peterson said, it's not all in any one person, because if you get them individually and sort of question them individually, sort of like a cop does to, or like the teacher does to sort of, you know, take the students apart from each other to find out what really happened. You say, well, what do you think about that joke? Well, I didn't have any problem with that joke. What do you think about that joke? I thought the joke was fine. What do you think about the joke? I thought the joke was funny. But put them all together and they're like, oh, no, we'd better not. Okay, well, what is acting in the room when they come together and do that? Now, someone might say, oh, but that's just psychology. Okay, well, tell me what psychology is. Tell me what sociology is. That's just their culture. Okay, tell me what their culture is. What makes that up? Does it have agency? It's certainly moving the people around. It's certainly moving their ideas around. And again, all over the culture, we imagine that by changing policies, putting up flags, having holidays, reading notes, having people do the work or study a book or something like that, that somehow we can change these things that are above us, that are controlling us. We all talk. In fact, governments spend millions of dollars. Propaganda is all about that. This is what, I mean, this is the focus of the Grim Grizz Jacob conversation. But then when we say, well, let's pay some attention to what that is. Oh no, you silly religious person. Okay.
Print functioned in the human, but that is the argument that I've heard him make.
I think I understand. I think he's basing that on information integration theory, which I think applies to metaconsciousness, self-awareness, right. Metacognition, not necessarily to consciousness in the phenomenal sense.
Okay, now we'll pay attention to what we're doing. We're working on vocabulary. So metaconsciousness, which is sort of conscious of being conscious. And there's, if you can search on YouTube, you can find, you know, people painting lines on the back of pretty gutsy people on the back of gorillas and putting them in front of a mirror, and the gorillas, can the gorilla figure out that they're the thing in the mirror, or maybe a bear, or maybe a cat, and find out which animals have metaconsciousness and which don't?
It's pure experience. So I think he is probably conflating the two, like a lot of neuroscientists today conflate the two. But I understand where it's coming from.
Ooh, we got a little bit of rivalry between. Of course, Kastrup has had some considerable conversations with John Vervaeke too.
I also don't agree, because when I talk about consciousness, I talk about phenomenal consciousness, not metaconsciousness. But I understand them.
Now, part of what's difficult about these conversations is when you get into Kastrup's idealism, the distinction he just made there will make sense, and it's being governed by, again, his worldview, as it were.
Motivation. Now, back to your point. What I would warn against, Jonathan, is...
Now, warn is an interesting word here.
Attributing private conscious inner life to anything we have or can make up a word for. Because words are...
Now, the key word to watch in this next little section is private. Well, what does he mean? Well, this again is sort of meta-consciousness. It's conscious of being conscious. It's, here's the thing, does the climate that caused all of those Netflix producers to sort of shrink back, what is the phenomenology, what is the experience of that agency, of that, dare we say, consciousness? Now, again, I've made this point so often. For all of my life, I've heard in public discourse that nobody bats an eye at, we need to raise the consciousness of the people. Well, I suppose when I wake up in the morning, you might say, is my consciousness being raised from sleep where I'm sort of paying attention to dreams inside my head, or that I think are inside my head, into a fuller state of awareness? Is that consciousness raising? Is my conscious something that you can sort of turn up and down like volume on an old stereo? Those were things that we had back when I was a teenager. Is that the kind of thing we're talking about? No, consciousness raising is that we're going to take some immoral situation like treatment, how the Chinese are treating such and such a people, and now we all know that the Chinese are treating such and such a people badly. So now we no longer buy iPhones. What exactly do we do in other, once our consciousness is raised, and what exactly are we talking about?
What is China? Does it include Tibet and Hong Kong and Macau or not? And depending on the decision you make here, whether China includes these three things or not, does it affect the ontological reality of there being an angel of China or a separate angel for China and another one for Hong Kong and another one for Macau and another one for Tibet?
Now, I like the point that he made there, because when Jonathan Peugeot used the word angel for what we're talking about here, myself and a bunch of others sort of backed off and said, we're kind of making angels. But I would say spirit, because that's a word that in our language does work. There is, in a sense, a spirit of America, which would be like all the states. There is, in a sense, the spirit of the West, which would be California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Montana, Idaho, Washington, Oregon. So you could say the spirit of the West, and that's sort of a thing we talk about. And then we could say West Coast, so then it's just California, Oregon, Washington, and that would be different from the spirit of the West. And we can easily talk that way. And to say an angel of these things in our sort of Cartesian-issued dilemma where when we hear spirit, we think ghost. No, ghost is a separate thing, ghost and geist and spirit. So, I mean, part of what we're trying to do here is come up with language, assuming that if we, in fact, continue to work on the language, maybe then, in fact, we can have more knowledge. And if we have more knowledge and better knowledge, we can have more agency, et cetera, et cetera.
You see what I mean?
Yeah.
The same applies to a table in the case of panpsychism. Mm-hmm. If the panpsychist says the table is conscious, has a private inner life of its own.
Now, again, private inner life of its own. This, I think, is part of the problem of this conversation, and the same thing we had in Thunder Bay with John, is that we sort of keep projecting our experience of consciousness onto what we imagine this consciousness would be. Now, obviously, in Christian theology, we do this with respect to God. But we don't know what the phenomenology of such a consciousness or agency would be. And this is where we get into the question about demons. So if you go back, I'm going to say this, and it sounds terribly self-promotional, but what I do with my adult Sunday school class in those videos, and the videos all have a thumbnail that looks the same. It's me with a little screen, and it'll have something about the Bible. We're in Romans 4 right now. What I do in my adult Sunday school class is really working on all of this stuff with normal people, with their Bible study, where the rubber meets the road. That's part of what I'm doing. And working on this, you know, sort of projecting our consciousness up into that space. And so Bernardo Kastrup, fair enough. Maybe we need different language, but if you look at how we as a culture go about doing business, what we're anxious about, what we have our government spend money on, what churches do, we're up to our necks in this business. We just are. And so doing a little bit of work on it, probably a good thing. Now, private inner consciousness, when you use those words, it's like, do I think that the climate, as Andrew Schultz says, has a private inner consciousness, sort of projecting my experience up into that? I have to say, I have no idea. But fair enough, fair pushback.
If I pull out one of the feet of the table, one of the four legs, do I create some kind of dissociation and I create a new conscious entity?
And what he says here is part of my skepticism about panpsychism.
And does that new conscious entity reemerges with the table if I nail the leg back to the table, or a rock that detaches from a mountain? Does it become separate from the mountain with an inner life, a private inner life of its own? And does it reunite every time it touches the mountain as it bounces off the slope? So we create a mess if we see everything identifiable through a noun, through a word, as an agent, as a conscious agent, because you know, the way we apply words is arbitrary. The way we define sets, subsets, and supersets in language is arbitrary. It's nominal, as philosophers call it. It's done by convenience and doesn't necessarily reflect any ontological reality.
Okay, so there are two things I would say to that, or that I think when I hear that. One is I can apply again the same problem to myself. If I see myself as a conscious agent, I can ask myself.
And I think Jonathan also has a strong point here. And I think this issue that he's pointing to is very much part of the meaning crisis, because the skepticism that we have in terms of what we're talking about when, as Andrew Schultz says, the climate. And again, he's not talking about temperature and wind and clouds. The same skepticism we have looking up, in a sense, we now have looking at ourselves. That's in many ways really the heart of the meaning crisis for a lot of people.
When I cut, does my hair participate in my conscious agency? You know, do my fingernails?
Now, what's interesting is, let's say Jonathan Peugeot shaved his head. How does that work in his terms of his identity, in terms of who he is, in terms of, I mean, this is all enormously complex, yet what should amaze us is just how well we manage this on a very regular basis.
About if I cut a finger off, does the finger now, you know, so I can ask the same question. This is why that I tend to think that categories are captured in their name or in the place where they come together, rather than try to find them contained in the place where their multiplicity has a possibility of breaking apart, let's say.
I see your point, but I think you miss the one criterion we have to define the boundaries of us as individual agents with private conscious inner life of their own. And it's a criterion that applies to us and doesn't apply to objects, doesn't apply to the table, to the mountain, or to China. And it's the following. If I pierce the chair I'm sitting on with a needle, I don't feel it. But if I pierce my arm, I do feel it.
Yeah.
If a photon in my study hits the wall behind me, I don't see it. But if it hits my retina, I do experience it. So there is a objective.
Even sight doesn't work quite that simply. Yeah, I've been reading Oliver Sacks, which is, again, 30-year-old neuroscience, and it's amazing how complex our experience of the world is and how effortless we are at managing within it.
A criterion for defining the boundaries of the human being, and that is what you register as an experience when something interacts with it, and what you don't register as an experience when something interacts with it.
Now his idealism is all through this, and so that's a piece of this here.
Now, I acknowledge that based on this criterion, there is a question that is valid, which is, are we the totality of ourselves, or are we only our nervous system? Because it's only the nervous system that registers, you know, that there are no nerve terminations in your hair.
Now, it's what's interesting, though, is, again, if you go back to the question about nerve cells versus other cells, there's a lot going on there.
So it's not part of you. But then I would say, well, there are no living cells in your hair either. It's just keratin. The same applies for your nails. So I see that there is a question there, but I don't think it's a free-for-all.
I don't think it's a free-for-all either, for sure. But in terms of China, for example, I agree with the table. But let's say if you look at China, the question that you ask could be answered in terms of China. So in terms of boundaries. So you would say, so imagine there's China, and then there are a bunch of people that are coming in and taking things like from another state. You know, they take refuse, maybe they take the trash on the side, and when they do that, they don't hurt China, and China doesn't care. But then at some point, maybe they come in and they start to take things, or they take part of the land, or they take certain things that China perceives as belonging to it, and then China will react very much like a pain reaction, will send out soldiers, antibodies, and will push away the threat that it is feeling on itself. And so if you see it that way, then at some point the question of Tibet or Macau or these other identities would be something like, you can imagine it like it's a conflict of identities. This is what's happening. There is a conflict of identity where China wants to extend its body to include these smaller identities, and those identities are resisting.
Like Taiwan.
You can almost imagine it like someone in the forest hunting a deer and wants to integrate the deer into himself, and the deer is resisting.
My street has a neighborhood watch. So if there is a strange person doing funny things on my street, it will be ejected by the nervous system of the street. Does my street have an angel? Is there an angel of the street where Bernardo lives?
Yeah, I don't know. These are the questions that I'm asking.
But there is a spirit. He would probably easily say there is a spirit of my street or a spirit of my community, because if a new neighbor moved in and you could have, you know, near limitless idiosyncrasies that the neighbors would readily detect as a violation of the spirit of the street, what would happen would then be there would be an alteration of the spirit of the street, and you'd say, well, the spirit of the street before this neighbor moved in was this way, and after this neighbor moved in was that way. One of my neighbors who moved in, this is on my street, years and years ago, came around and introduced himself to everyone who lived in the neighborhood when he moved in. And in an American community, that's kind of like, oh, okay, that's friendly. That's sort of good, but a little odd. And then he came around and said, well, why don't we have a 4th of July block party? And I'll talk to the city and we'll close off the street and we'll do this. And for a number of years, we had this 4th of July block party. And he changed the spirit of the street. And then he, at some point, sold his house and left the street, and the spirit of the street changed again. Now, I appreciate Kastrup's pushback on, say, using angel, because for the most part, the way we imagine angels to be would be something that is has a little bit more durable ontology and is less emergent from what's going on in the street. But now, again, back to my school spirit example, part of the spirit of the street goes back even before there was a street, because the geology of the street gets built into the spirit of the street. Maybe your street is in San Francisco, and maybe, or Los Angeles, and maybe you know you're going to have an earthquake. That's part of the spirit of the street. And so this is a really important way of talking, and so I appreciate Kastrup's pushback. And a little bit later, gosh, I'm kind of running out of time, but
I'm trying to figure out because there are some, for example, there are some theologians that go all out with this. They'll say as soon as two people encounter themselves, there is a third being there. As soon as two people have a conversation, there's a third.
See, and I think in some ways, even though that theological habit had its purpose, I think part of some of the solvent of, let's say, what was applied in the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment sort of, I think, helped to recalibrate some of that, because a being. But, you know, I'd often challenge people. I'd say, okay, if you want to get a sense of your marriage, why don't you name it? Because if you name your marriage Disneyland, well, you're saying something about your marriage. If you name your marriage Vietnam, you're saying something about your marriage, depending on if you're meaning the Vietnam War or this other beautiful island, et cetera, this beautiful country, et cetera, et cetera. So this is part of the nuance and amazing power that we actually have. Now, I wonder if I can find this, because I'm running out of time and I can't just play it through. Okay, it's a good thing I didn't try to play it through, because this is a lot longer. And Kastrup has there's a lot of influence from Jung in Kastrup, which is, again, his idealism is obviously a significant part in what he's approaching here.
That narrative, that little person born on that date, married to that other person who has this job and so forth. That's the ego. That's the first level. The next level is what is yours personally, but it's beyond the ego. In Jungian terminology, the personal unconscious. It's all your repressed stuff, the stuff that you don't acknowledge about yourself, the memories that you're not recalling. It's still you as an individual mind, but it's well beyond your ego. And it's much, much, much bigger than the ego, but it's still you as an individual agent. And then there is a transpersonal, which in Jungian terminology would be the collective unconscious, which is still psychic, it's still mental, it's still phenomenally conscious, it's just not metaconscious. And there are psychic processes.
And I think, again, so he's not having a problem with, say, conscious for this, but it's not metaconscious. So again, if I'm understanding him correctly, My dog isn't particularly metaconscious. I don't have a dog right now. But let's say if I had a pet, it's not particularly metaconscious, but it is conscious. And it just shows, again, this question of self-conscious.
There are psychic complexes that Jung called the diamonds that may not have a physical correlate, which evolution did not have a motivation to create in us a perceptual apparatus capable of picking those entities out, because they may not have a direct bearing on our ability to survive.
That comment I found enormously interesting, because I think we do, and I think we're exercising it now. And whereas, and I illustrate it in this way often, the chimpanzees and gorillas in Africa that are facing extinction are not anxious about their extinction. Part of that has to do with their metaconsciousness, but part of it has to do with their inability to, okay, let's talk about climate change. Now, we are talking about wind patterns and temperature and all of that. Again, there's our culture demonstrates, when it went to Europe, one of the real interesting things was just how conscious they were of those issues. All over the Netherlands, Kastrup lives in the Netherlands, signs and billboards and consciousness, a tremendous amount of consciousness given to questions of climate change and these sorts of issues. Very interesting. Are we capable of dealing with that? And so I think part of what has happened is in the corrective that we saw in the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment, as is the case almost always, when we attempt to correct, we usually either undercorrect or overcorrect. I mean, getting the correction right, probably impossible for human beings who are experience total depravity, let's say. All of our capacity to do this is limited and in some ways impaired by our rebellion. I just triggered a whole bunch of narrative things, and some of you are going to be triggered by that pretty well. But that's part of this too, that in effect we have an ability to deal with this. And if you look at the history of humanity, we have been dealing with this. Why on earth is Netherlands full of churches? Well, we can't see it, and go back to Andrew Schultz and the climate that he sees manifest in all of the Netflix workers or the committee that is supposed to regulate content moderation, et cetera, et cetera. We have a sense of it. And this is what we're using. And in some ways, we've just sort of been hobbled by this same Reformation, Enlightenment, to now say, oh, there's no such thing as the climate that the Netflix employees are trying to address. Really? The Netflix employees believe so. Andrew Schultz believes so. We all believe so. And it's become an enormous preoccupation for the culture itself. Hopefully this has been helpful. I came in today with about 5 videos that I'd love to make, and I know, again, a bunch of you said, oh, you should talk about Cosmic Skeptic, and I was probably a little, I don't know, some of you like those kind of videos, some of you don't, a little snitty when I made those videos, just because I get tired of hearing this, and bang, I sort of reacted. And again, some of you like the reaction, some of you don't. But I, at the same time, I do understand that there are a lot of people who are, in many ways, held bondage to the climate, and they're stuck in it. And so they're under the sway of its power. Number of years ago, when I talked about reading C.S. Lewis's book Miracles 2 or 3 times a year, it's because I did that in order to not be under the sway of a certain climate. And when I post conversations by Grim Grizz and Chad the Alcoholic and Jacob, that they're meeting together and talking with each other so as not to be under the influence of the climate. These things are very real, and they're very difficult for us to deal with. And when Kastrup says evolution hasn't equipped us, well, we're amazingly equipped, both equipped and ill-equipped by evolution on whole numbers of ranges. You know, our skin is too soft, our hair is too, you know, we don't have fur for the weather, on and on and on and on and on. And I would say that just like we don't seem equipped by evolution to dominate the planet, our capacity to actually deal with these things, however conscious we are of them, seems second to none on the planet. And what we're struggling with is actually coming to some agreement with respect to language and approaches, agreements which had been come to throughout the centuries of human history in that very dangerous area that secularism pushed off into a corner called religion. Dum, dum, dum. So here we are. Out of time. Leave a comment.